the Chinese government will need to make a choice about, you know, again, whether it's rallying domestic support for it, flexing its muscles, so to speak, is worth the cost in potential international goodwill and, again, willingness to travel, willingness to do business.
Hello, and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Chris Park, and I'm joined by my co-host, Amanda. Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou was allowed to leave Canada in late September after spending more than 1,000 days under house arrest in Vancouver on an American extradition request. China subsequently set free Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, referred to as the two Michaels, who have been detained since 2018. While the three-year-old saga now appears to be over, important questions have been raised about the politics of extradition, specter of hostage diplomacy, and the necessary response to such practices. Professor Shimen Keitner joins us today to discuss hostage diplomacy and the case of the two Michaels.
Professor Shimen Keitner is a leading authority on international law and civil litigation. She served as the 27th Counselor on International Law in the U.S. Department of State. She has authored two books and dozens of articles, essays, and book chapters on questions surrounding the relationship between law, communities, and borders, including issues of jurisdiction, foreign sovereignty, and official immunity, and the historical understandings underpinning current practices in these areas. She currently serves as the Alpha and Hannah Fromm Professor of International Law at the University of California, Hastings Law.
Thank you so much, Shimen, for coming on the podcast today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Before getting into the recent developments, I wanted to talk about some of the key individuals involved in this case. First, who is Meng Wanzhou, and why was she arrested in Canada in 2018 and placed in house arrest until recently?
Well, Ms. Wanzhou, as I understand it, is somewhat of a Chinese celebrity. And if she wasn't before, she certainly is now. She's the chief financial officer of Huawei, which is a giant telecommunications company that is not at the moment directly owned by the Chinese government, but is thought to have very close connections with the Chinese Communist Party. And her father actually founded the company. So when she was changing planes, as I understand it, in Vancouver in December of 2018, authorities in the United States apparently got wind of that and made a request, an urgent request, under the U.S.-Canada extradition treaty for Canadian authorities to arrest her. And she has, until just a couple weeks ago, been under house arrest in Vancouver as a result of that extradition request from the United States, which was making its way through the Canadian courts.
Mm-hmm. And the other core players in this case are Canadians Michael Spavor, a private travel consultant, and Michael Kovrig, a former Canadian diplomat. Why and when were they detained in China? And how were their detentions perhaps related to Meng's case?
Well, of course, the Chinese government has consistently denied that there is any connection between their arrest of the two gentlemen who've come to be known as the two Michaels and Meng's arrest. But the timing was certainly very close. So Meng's arrest in Canada was made public on December 5th. On December 10th of 2018, the two Michaels were taken into custody. And for a very long time, it wasn't really clear what the basis was for their detention. It wasn't until June 19th of 2020 that they were both charged with espionage. And in fact, just this summer in August, Michael Spavor was sentenced to 11 years on that espionage charge. Michael Kovrig, as far as I understand, had not yet been sentenced. But very early on, even though there were official disclaimers of any linkages between Canada's arrest of Meng in response to the U.S. extradition request and the arrest of these two Canadians, in the public mind, and I think very much in the diplomatic mind as well, this was a real tit-for-tat situation. Additionally, another Canadian, Robert Schellenberg, had been sentenced just before Meng's arrest to 15 years in a Chinese court for drug trafficking. That sentence was changed around the same time to a death sentence, which is now under review by the Supreme People's Court in China. And there was a precedent for this in 2014, when the United States requested the extradition of Su Bin from Canada on hacking charges. China also at that point arrested a Canadian couple, and it took some time for them to be released as well.
Great. So on September 24th, Meng was allowed to leave Canada after reaching a deal with the U.S. Department of Justice over these allegations of fraud. So can you explain what these DOJ charges were about and how this agreement came into play?
Well, in order to request her extradition to begin with, a U.S. court needs to have issued an arrest warrant. And that happened back in August of 2018. The charges on which she was wanted in the U.S. criminal justice system relate to her alleged misrepresentations, which is part of this agreement she has now admitted to making. We can get to that in a minute, that she misled a major financial institution, which has now essentially been revealed as HSBC, to encourage them to loan money to Huawei while reassuring them falsely that Huawei was not doing business in Iran. Kind of zooming out, as everyone is well aware, the United States and Iran have had very intense relationship relating to nonproliferation, among other things. And one of the United States's major strategies in trying to squeeze the regime in Iran has been imposing very severe sanctions. And those sanctions are not just what we might call direct sanctions, prohibiting U.S. businesses from selling goods in Iran or entering into contracts with Iranian entities, but they've also included what are called secondary sanctions. And so any entity or individual who is, you know, within the reach of these secondary sanctions is also prohibited from doing business with Iran or in Iran on penalty of violating U.S. criminal law. And so the allegations range, cover conduct, as I understand it, that ranged over the years 2010 to 2014. It seems that a pivotal point in the sort of sequence of alleged misrepresentations came in a meeting in which Meng was presenting slides in Hong Kong that essentially concealed the links between Huawei and two shell companies that Huawei has used to do business in Iran. And so the actual charges related to conspiracy to commit bank fraud, which is a, you know, garden variety criminal charge and a fairly serious one at that. But the context in which this alleged bank fraud took place was the alleged avoidance of secondary sanctions, an attempt to circumvent the United States' sanctions on Iran.
Great. And can you talk about how this deal was reached or negotiated between Meng and the U.S. DOJ?
Well, my understanding is that her lawyers, and certainly she's been very well represented throughout this process, have been discussing a possible what's called deferred prosecution agreement since the summer. So as a general matter, when an extradition request is made, the normal process would be that it would be dealt with expeditiously in the courts of the requested state. So in this case, Canada, the individual would be extradited, and then the criminal justice process would take its course in the requesting state, here the United States, according to standard U.S. criminal procedure. There are, of course, in the United States, many criminal charges that never actually go to trial in which defendants plead guilty. And perhaps agree to a less severe sentence in exchange for a guilty plea. And then this deferred prosecution agreement is something a little bit different. So it doesn't involve a guilty plea, but it does mean that the United States withdrew its extradition request. So this means now that Canada is no longer under a treaty obligation to extradite Meng, or at least to use its procedures to review the extradition request and then make an ultimate determination about whether or not to extradite her consistent with the treaty. And the sort of quid pro quo, as it were, in the deferred prosecution agreement is that she is then allowed to return to China. She's released on her personal recognizance. And for the next 4 years, so until December 1st, Oh, I'll have to check actually the date in which that expires, but she's not allowed to, she and her lawyers are not allowed to contradict the factual admissions that she has made. In other words, the criminal case that is still proceeding against Huawei itself, so a corporate criminal case, will likely rely on these admissions as evidence in the Huawei prosecution. And so her agreement with the Justice Department is not only that she admitted these factual predicates involving fraudulent statements, but also that she will not essentially recant. Now, of course, even though DOJ could theoretically, you know, reinstate these charges and resume the prosecution if she goes back on that agreement, as long as she's in China, there's really no risk to her that she would be surrendered to a U.S. court. So in theory, this is still sort of hanging over her as a way of enforcing this agreement that she will stick by these admissions. In practice, I think she is now beyond the reach of U.S. courts.
Great. So yeah, like we said, she's arrived in China. So how did China and Canada respond to their respective return of their citizens? And how will this case impact the relationship between the two countries going forward?
Well, the Canada-China relationship is a really complicated one. And looking at public opinion polls, this whole ordeal, I think, has really given Canadians pause in the extensive business relationships that Canadians and Chinese companies have been developing over the years. The release of the two Michaels came within hours of the announcement that Meng was on a plane back to China and had left Canadian airspace. And I think that took many observers by surprise. I think many people assumed and hoped that they would be released in due course, because it really did seem that their arrest had been purely pretextual. At the same time, China has, in many respects, been presenting itself as a country that abides by both a domestic and international rule of law. In other words, that it follows procedures. A lot of its complaints about this extradition request and about the Canadian procedures turned on allegations that the United States and Canada were politicizing this extradition request, that they weren't following the rule of law. And so if the idea was to suggest or to try to maintain the position that the two Michaels had been arrested because there were, you know, well-founded national security concerns about their activities in China, that pretense has certainly gone out the window. And so one can imagine that those making the decisions in China to release them, in fact, wanted to send perhaps the opposite message, which is actually trying to link these two releases together, even though we have no reason to believe, and there's nothing in the public record that would suggest that the deferred prosecution agreement was at all linked to a Chinese agreement to release the Michaels. And then also with a day after this release, two American siblings who had been prevented from leaving China. So they hadn't been arrested, but they were subject to what we refer to as an exit ban. They were allowed to return to the United States after having been prevented from leaving for 3 years. So again, there's a linkage in terms of the timing, but we have no evidence that there's an actual linkage in terms of some sort of behind the scenes deal. My understanding is that Meng's return was celebrated like a national holiday. It was broadcast live by state media during a 6-hour live stream that apparently garnered 83 million views. By comparison, when China sent 3 astronauts into space last June, there were 35 million views. So this really was a national celebration. And those who follow Chinese domestic politics more than I do have suggested that this really shows, and I find this interpretation quite plausible, that Beijing values domestic support more than its international image. And so closely linking the release of the Michaels to Meng's release, I think really does undermine China's narrative that it is a country that follows the rule of law. But clearly, this was tremendously popular domestically, and the government very successfully portrayed itself as having been victorious in securing, finally, the release of its maltreated citizen who'd been detained in under house arrest in her million-dollar mansion in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, you know, Chinese government perhaps was attempting to link the Meng Wanzhou case with the two Michaels. And many observers have called this an example of hostage diplomacy. As you wrote in Foreign Affairs, individuals have long been used as pawns in interstate disputes. And, you know, this was written back in 2019, and you raised the specter of hostage diplomacy back then. For our listeners, can you explain what hostage diplomacy is?
Sure. It's really, in a sense, an oxymoron, right? Because hostage taking is the exact opposite of diplomacy, which means constructive engagement on issues of mutual concern. But as you mentioned, Chris, back in January of 2019, I did write this piece in particular because I was very concerned, as were many others, about statements that then President Trump was making that explicitly did link Meng's fate to a potential U.S.-China trade deal. Now, of course, at that point, the issue was firmly within the jurisdiction of Canadian courts, but under an extradition treaty, it is ultimately up to the requesting state either to pursue extradition or to withdraw its request, which is ultimately what happened on September 24th of this year. So it really did muddy the waters. And my view, of course, I have served in the U.S. government, but I had left by this point, so I have no inside information whatsoever. But it seemed to me, especially given that this was a provisional arrest warrant that did not, as I understand it under the treaty, go through the normal diplomatic channels, but rather seems to have been, again, just based on what was publicly reported, an opportunistic interception of Meng as she was changing planes in Vancouver. It really does seem difficult for me to believe, especially given the rather disorganized national security state in the Trump presidency, that there was some sort of premeditated linkage of this arrest to sort of the broader U.S.-China trade squabbles. That said, once President Trump made those statements, it really did give China and Meng's lawyers, for that matter, a strong basis to at least claim that the extradition request was politically motivated. And in most bilateral extradition treaties, there are some standard terms in the treaties that provide, number one, that the crime for which an extradition is sought or an individual's extradition is sought be a crime in both the requesting and the requested state. We call that a dual criminality or double criminality requirement. And also, the requested state is not obliged under the treaty to extradite an individual if the offense is what's generally referred to as a political offense, which has been construed as including requests that are politically motivated. So in part because of these requirements, the case in Canada had been going on for quite some time as lawyers for representing the Canadian Attorney General, under whose auspices this arrest and extradition proceeding was taking place. And of course, Meng's lawyers had gone through multiple rounds of court hearings and in fact had just finished up and the court had said it was going to announce a decision on October 21st. Now, had the court proceeded to issue a decision on the 21st, the court would have either said that the conditions provided for in the bilateral extradition treaty were satisfied and so Meng is extraditable, or that she was not. And if the court had found her extraditable, there would have been an additional political layer, because under, again, sort of standard bilateral extradition treaties, the final sign-off on an extradition actually comes at the political level. And so in Canada, it would have been the Minister of Justice who would have had to sign off on the extradition. And I provide that by way of background because these bilateral extradition treaties do structure essentially, requests for arrests and transfer of criminal suspects in a very systematic way. Hostage diplomacy, by contrast, is completely ad hoc. So the idea being that, and I think the clearest examples of going outside of extradition treaties would be During the Cold War period, where we saw a number of so-called spy swaps, one country would identify another country's spies on its territory, would arrest them, could, of course, prosecute them for espionage. But sometimes, instead of going through with the prosecution, the country on whose behalf they were spying would, in turn, identify and round up spies sent by or allegedly sent by the other country. And so instead of each country prosecuting the other country's spies under their own domestic criminal laws, they would essentially exchange these detainees and sort of call it even and start over again as far as their mutual spying was concerned. So that kind of exchange is certainly not unprecedented, and some of them continue between various countries still today. The hostage element, though, really indicates this idea that somebody is being arrested and detained solely for the purpose of providing leverage in other diplomatic contexts, whether it be trying to secure the release of a national or some other context like sanctions, for example. And this, I think, is a much less common phenomenon. It's much more frightening in the sense that the individuals targeted for arrest, the two Michaels, for example, appear to have been targeted essentially solely for their nationality and not because they were, in fact, even plausibly engaged in any kind of espionage activities. And so this sort of orderly exchange of prisoners or kind of mutual apprehension of suspected spies for the purpose of securing the liberation of one's own spies has sort of natural boundaries around it. But when we expose kind of the traveling population at large to the potential of arbitrary arrest and detention, I think that's much more concerning. And so the term hostage diplomacy, I think, refers to that phenomenon of an arbitrary arrest for the purpose of securing diplomatic leverage. But it is absolutely something that we should all strive to avoid establishing as a model for how to proceed. And I think that's especially why you see very strong denials, particularly on the US side, that there was any linkage whatsoever between the release of the Michaels and this deferred prosecution agreement.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned perhaps hostage-taking behavior, you know, not only from the Chinese side, but under the American side, during the Trump administration. Should the Huawei case and the release of both Meng and the two Michaels be considered as an example of the success of hostage diplomacy, either on the Chinese side or the American or the Canadian side?
Yeah, so just to be absolutely clear, I have no reason to believe that the initial provisional arrest warrant or extradition request was at all politically motivated. You know, Rod Rosenstein, who was then in charge of kind of setting the priorities for the Department of Justice, had made clear sometime earlier that the United States was really going to go after cases of alleged industrial espionage and kind of come down in ways that have subsequently been criticized, particularly on Chinese individuals and companies. And so in the broader geopolitical context, I suppose, that is turning perhaps undue attention to Chinese defendants. But I really don't think that there was a specific decision made at a high political level that we should go after this one individual. In fact, to the contrary, I think the whole 3 years has been to the detriment of all three countries in terms of their respective relationships and international standing. And Canada, you know, certainly was caught in the middle here. I mean, again, unless they were going to flagrantly disregard their international legal obligation under the bilateral extradition treaty, they really had no choice but to arrest, issue this, to act on this provisional arrest warrant. I do think, though, that after the arrest had happened, you're absolutely right. I think that remarks that President Trump made, again, in my view, sort of retrospectively, it turned this into a potential sort of tit-for-tat trade of individuals, linking it not only, or in fact, not even in his case, to the release of any detainees in China, but rather to this sort of broader trade negotiations between the two countries, which I think is just abhorrent. And it really that theme was not pursued. And I think we can regard that hopefully as just an aberration of President Trump's view of global relations more generally. It would be very concerning if we started to see more examples that, again, that from their inception appeared to follow this model. But it's really a difficult situation, I think, that Canada in particular found itself in, because again, it was caught between the legal obligation under the extradition treaty with, you know, a major ally and trading partner to go through with this extradition process. And so again, I don't at all envy the justice minister on whose desk this would have landed. At the same time, China was, you know, again, a very important economic partner for Canada, and Canada has still not decided whether it is going to proceed with using Huawei as a supplier for its 5G network. I think I've heard that Canadian telecoms companies generally have been avoiding it, so maybe the decision has already been made without the government having to weigh in. But it's I think it's emblematic of a world in which China cannot be ignored, cannot be disregarded as a secondary power. It has tremendous both military and economic might, but it seems to also be struggling to define its identity as a global player. On the one hand, speaking the language of the law, but on the other hand, really engaging in this self-proclaimed wolf warrior diplomacy in which, you know, to echo a cliche, might makes right. And now that we have an administration in the United States that, again, you know, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said there is no link between these two actions, is trying to discourage and disincentivize these kind of trades of individuals. But I do worry. You asked, was this a successful example of hostage diplomacy? I think absolutely not. I think it redounded, again, to the detriment of all three countries involved. At the same time, Canada is, everyone who was watching this situation evolve is tremendously relieved that the Michaels are back home, and very concerned about what China's willingness to detain and hold them means for essentially the safety and security of foreign nationals traveling in China going forward.
Great. So you've already started to do this, but I wanted to kind of go a little bit more in depth with other examples of hostage diplomacy. So is China the primary perpetrator of this tactic thus far, or has it been used by other nation states, including even the United States?
So again, I'm unaware of any situations in which the United States has arbitrarily detained a particular individual for the sole purpose of gaining leverage in securing the release of an American held abroad. But again, I'd be glad for listeners to bring those to my attention. We can talk about them individually. The instances that have made the headlines have involved, for example, right, the detention of Americans in Russia. You might remember when Maria Butina was arrested in the United States as a Russian agent. And Russia seems to have sort of responded in kind. I talked a little bit about in the foreign affairs piece about Turkey's practice of detaining Americans and sort of attempt to engage in prisoner swaps, so to speak. Again, in a context in which they're entirely inappropriate. But I think that the tricky thing from the perspective of countries that don't want this to become sort of an international practice is a similar dilemma to that involved in deciding whether or not to pay ransoms for sort of the more traditional category of hostages, right? Whether they're taken hostage by nation states or, as has often been the case, by non-state groups or terrorist actors. My understanding is that, you know, the United States stands by its policy of not paying ransoms for American hostages, which is a policy that has definitely frustrated, to say the least, family members of Americans detained abroad. Now, certainly the United States deploys, you know, the full range of diplomatic efforts to try and secure the release of Americans held abroad. But paying ransoms has not traditionally been part of that toolbox, precisely because of a concern that it would simply incentivize more hostage taking. By contrast, my understanding is that countries in the European Union have been much more willing to pay ransoms in analogous situations. And so, you know, I would encourage listeners kind of stepping back from this particular situation to think about, you know, whether or not on a systemic level, it makes sense for countries to essentially legitimize this tactic by either, you know, actually or apparently making it look like it succeeds, but at potentially the expense of, again, you know, these individuals languishing in Chinese prisons for years, including many years during which they had not even been charged with a crime. On the other hand, if we rush to secure the release of individuals, I do think there's a danger of incentivizing, you know, future similar behavior. And as a general matter, the, you know, high degree of interconnection among all of these countries, you know, going back to China, Canada, and the United States in terms of trade and business ties, not to mention, you know, academic exchanges, cultural exchanges, I think will really be hampered if individuals don't have a basic sense of security that you know, they will not be made pawns in some sort of larger disputes with which they have no personal involvement whatsoever.
You know, given this case and everything we discussed on the podcast today, can we expect China or any other nation to use hostage diplomacy more readily moving forward? And should this trend continue, how should the United States respond?
Look, in the short term, I think business executives, you know, maybe even tourists who might otherwise have traveled to China, sort of bracketing the COVID epidemic, which is, of course, limiting people's travel for other reasons. You know, I think people will think twice before traveling to China. And conversely, of course, I think the recognition that the U.S.-Canada extradition agreement remains quite robust, you know, might deter some people from China or those who feel like they might be in the sights of the Department of Justice for, you know, fraud or secondary sanctions violations or what have you, might well avoid North America. I think it will remain to be seen whether instances of this occur in the next couple of years. If they don't, my guess is we'll see a reversion to sort of business as usual. Again, the 2014 incident that I mentioned earlier doesn't seem to have had a huge sort of palpable effect on kind of cross-border travel more broadly. But I do think the Chinese government will need to make a choice about, you know, again, whether it's rallying domestic support for its flexing its muscles, so to speak, is worth the cost in potential international goodwill and, again, willingness to travel, willingness to do business in China. Conversely, I think this whole episode has really contributed to increasing wariness of Canadians and the Canadian government of relying too heavily only on the United States. I mean, the United States put Canada in a very difficult position here, and ultimately, you know, there were, as I understand it, a number of very prominent voices in Canada urging Prime Minister Trudeau to somehow put an end to the extradition proceedings even before the United States withdrew its extradition request. And, you know, Canadian courts proceeded to adjudicate this case and not to let kind of this political pressure derail the proceedings. So if to the extent that hostage diplomacy, quote unquote, worked, the agreement that ultimately led to this series of events, as you and Amanda have pointed out, was this deferred prosecution agreement with the Department of Justice. And there is, as you can imagine, plenty of speculation about exactly what stars aligned to produce this agreement at this point in the proceedings, whether it was, you know, concern for the Michaels, whether it was a recognition that Meng's lawyers in the Canadian proceedings were raising some arguments that perhaps would have led the Canadian courts to find her not extraditable, which would then have, deprived the Justice Department even of her factual admissions. So I'm sure there are many moving pieces here, most of which we will, on the outside, all remain unaware. But again, I think that on a systemic level, it seems to me to be more prudent not to give in to these sorts of tactics. At the same time, we simply can't deny the human tragedies that result, and the fact that, again, just to focus on the two Michaels, although we also talk about, you know, these siblings who had the exit bans placed on them, the Canadian whose 15-year sentence was changed to a death sentence, you know, individual lives really do hang in the balance. And so I completely understand how there's a very natural instinct to focus on those particular instances. But I think the systemic costs of linking detention of individuals too much to kind of geopolitical outcomes will be a real rise in instability that in this day and age, you know, would be a really distressing development.
Thank you so much, Shimon, for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.